Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. I'm here with Wendy Wilson from Apothecary Herbs today, as she is joining us for the first segment of the program, and Alfred Adeth with James Corbett of the Corbett Report will follow for the balance of the program today. And today is Thursday, January 29th, 2015. So let's get started right away. I'm going to do the market report, and we had such a drastic change in gold today. Before we get to Wendy, let's do the market report. We have gold down 26.70 today at 1,257. You have silver down 1.04 at 1,702. Platinum was down 31 today at 1223, along with palladium also down 22 at 776. So the metals got blasted today. I could only expect it was a carryover from yesterday with the Federal Reserve's announcement that certainly that the economy is solid, is having solid growth. I'm not so sure why it didn't take it down after their comments yesterday, but the markets didn't do anything either, and the markets took off today in the paper markets. So a little bit of a strange reaction today. The only other report came out today was the U.S. weekly jobless claims. They fell, but you have to remember last week was a four-day week, so naturally it was going to drop. And they showed that the they fell by 43,000 to a seasonally adjusted 265,000 during the week to Labor Day. And, of course, we often look at the four-week moving average for new claims. So, you know, it balances out those days off on the week-to-week volatility. So that was down a little bit to 298,000, which really makes a little bit more sense. But certainly, again, they spin the information. So that, along with yesterday's announcement that we were on solid growth, probably had a little bit of impact on gold. But the fundamentals are still there. I mean, it doesn't change anything. They can tell us how great things are, but I can bring out an armload of reports and stats that show that the economy is not doing well, the people are not doing well, they have very little money to live on, and it's difficult for them. The wealthy certainly are getting wealthier on the people who are giving everything they have so they can no longer survive. We have an economy that certainly doesn't fare well for people for the middle class and for those that are not on government assistance, and certainly our monetary policies and so forth really don't change with our solid growth. They just continue to spend more. And so, again, we're in a spiral that will have a day of reckoning. And I believe, you know, when you have numbers like we see today in gold or in the stock markets and so forth, these are all one-day wonders, because the reality of everything will always come back. Reality rules, and the markets will do and match reality. Gold is a currency. We're having a currency war that's going on around this world. And certainly gold will react just based on the simple fundamentals that all the world is awash in fiat currencies. And gold is the only real currency. And that is what will be sought after as we see things continue to decline. So they can have their one-day wonders. They can have their glory moments. They can have all the manipulation and the yahoos that the elite can bring to everyone. But hang on to your gold and silver. Buy it when it dips. Don't feel bad if you bought a little bit higher price and we had this little bit of correction. No one has a crystal ball to see what prices are going to do on a day-to-day basis. And if everyone remembers what old Bob Chapman used to say, you just buy. And if you're fortunate enough to buy on the dips, you just continue to buy. You can't market time. You can't time the markets when it comes to purchasing gold and silver, because we're looking at long term for gold and silver. And certainly the long term is getting a little bit shorter. It's getting a little bit closer. But we don't speculate on the day-to-day basis on what the prices are doing. And with that, we're going to go with the Dow. The Dow was up 225 points. That really only came up after they really started hitting gold, 17,416. The NASDAQ was up 45 at 46.83. The S&P was up 19 points at 2021, along with the 10-year yield. That's still hovering around the 1.75% at up 0.03. So with those low yields on the 10-year, it still shows that you had a lot of people coming into, you know, they're looking for safety. They know what's going on out there. You'd have to be insane to hold on to paper in the world that we live in today, not knowing what's going to happen from day to day. And if you're making, if you have profits, folks, I'd be taking some and putting them into something that's going to offset all your other paper investments. And, of course, that is gold and silver. Give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And I'd like to say hello to Wendy Wilson.
Well, hello, Melody. Thank you so much for allowing me to change the day I'm with you. Yesterday was crazy. I had to get some orders out. So thanks for allowing me to come on today.
Absolutely. We'll miss Al today, but
good old Al.
But you're going to talk about vaccines today. And just to let you know, there was an article in the USA Today. Mm. I don't know if you had a chance to hear about this. I saw this just on Natural News Today, since you're going to be talking about vaccines. Well, there was an article they published. The columnist was Alex Brezow, and he says that parents who do not vaccinate their children should go to jail.
Yeah, I did see that. Dr. Carly saw it, too, and she made sure everybody else saw it. But, yeah, I mean, I think if you read most of the article, you get the gist that eventually I think they want to move to, even if you don't have kids, even if you don't personally, you want a flu shot, they'll probably, you know, have some sort of legal ramification for you. So, yeah, we're going to talk about the jab-free future, okay? You know, because there's lots of countries, Melanie, that are balking at having their children or even themselves for employment reasons to be vaccinated. And these reports are coming from the UK and from Australia as well as from the US. So parents are making a stand. They're starting to question and even refuse to comply with their government or employer enforced vaccines, or they're looking for ways around the laws to protect the health of their families. So that question is then, can a pharmaceutical vaccine, which are the most highly guarded treatment known to weaken your immune system, can they actually survive a free market then? I mean, you know, why all the pressure if it's good for you, right? Well, the answer is, if they can't, well, what are they going to do? Well, they're going to go to what is known as the jab-free future. And when I read that, I thought, oh, good, they're going to get rid of vaccines, but that's not what it means. They're actually going to step up the quantity, and they're also going to change the delivery system of the vaccine and give it to you without actually you ever knowing you've been vaccinated. So what this is an aerosol delivery vaccine, and the idea to do this goes back past 2003. There was a paper, Melody, that PubMed did. They explored the idea of what they called, quote, mass immunization of populations at rapid speed, end of quote. So the scientists have explored the aerosol vaccination, and they've practiced these delivery systems on developing countries and even disaster areas. So, you know, people are familiar with that flu nasal spray, but that's not what we're talking about, because that's a one-on-one patient doctor aerosol spray up your nose. We're talking about different kinds of sprays through the atmosphere. Now, the PubMed paper admits that thousands of people in Russia have been receiving aerosol vaccinations over a period of several years with live strains of diseases. So, and they've also taken tests, aerosol sprays over South America, and they were using live measles viruses and supposedly great success. So if anybody from South America went to Disneyland recently.
That's just what went through my mind, Wendy.
Okay, so the aerosol vaccinations, they've even also carried out live A strains of influenza. And according to the research, they say it's a big success. But you can't find any statistics, really, on people that were stricken ill with any diseases or any mortality rates due to this aerosol vaccination delivery system. Now, if parents follow the CDC recommendations on vaccines when they have children, a child would receive 49 doses of 14 different diseases by the age of 6. If the child's ready to go off to college, they should have received, according to the CDC, 69 doses of 16 different diseases. And if the parents buy into this, getting all these vaccines, they will spend $12,000 to treat their child with vaccines. And that doesn't account for any costs that may be incurred due to vaccine side effects. Now, did you hear about the report of Dr. Paul Offit? He's a doctor. He proclaimed that children can be expected to tolerate 19,000 vaccines given at one time, or a total of 100,000 vaccines by the time they're 18. Did you hear about that?
Well, I heard there was something about how these children can get these huge doses of so forth, but I didn't, you know, go into detail with it. Yeah.
Well, his quote was published in the Wire magazine. It's also his work was published in the Journal of Pediatrics. But currently, right now, children only get a total of maybe 5 vaccines at one time. And, of course, Dr. Offit would never subject himself to a lethal treatment because in his book, Autism False Prophets, he says this: although vaccines have probably saved more lives than any other medical intervention, they have come with a price, occasionally causing severe and even fatal side effects, end of quote. So there's a lot of mistrust in the vaccines. People started to mistrust vaccines back in the 70s, but it's even more evident today. But there's other countries that can sue where us Americans can't sue the pharmaceuticals. Other countries can. But if anybody's injured here in the United States from a vaccine, the pharmaceuticals don't pay. It's the taxpayer who pays the claim or the fees or the fines. So I think a lot of people are waking up to the vaccine issue, but they're not aware of the aerosol spraying scheme that they're going to go to. And they really don't care if you get aerosol sprayed with a vaccine. You've already had that vaccine in a traditional way. They don't care about you getting massive doses, and they don't really care that the dose you get is a child's going to get an adult dose either through this delivery system. Now, I want to mention, if I got time real quickly.
Well, you know, they could do that on smaller. I mean, are they talking about small venues to where they would release this aerosol with the vaccines, or, you know, plane flying over and release it
right.
to entire populations?
Yeah, I was going to get to that, but I'll answer you. The Department of Justice, under their 149AZ2 section, says that they will use burial vector spraying with six methods. Including high altitude release as well as water release, and also they're gonna throw it into insect transmission spraying. So they have lots of methods of diffusing this into the atmosphere where people will breathe them in, and I'll get to that in a minute, how that's gonna affect us. But real quick, want to mention the people of Australia. I don't have a whole lot of time to go into what's going to happen to them this year, but according to the gene technology regulator there, they have given PacVax a license to release a GMO vaccine with live bacteria, and it's a cholera bacteria. They will be vaccinating people in Queensland, South Australia, and Western Australia, and Victoria with this. Of course, you know, cholera is due to a sanitation issue. But they're being told this is just to develop a vaccine for cholera. But what happens if you look at what the WHO says about it, it says cholera can kill quickly following the onset of symptoms. And they also will tell you that if you contract cholera via contamination, either through food or water, and this aerosol spraying is going to be a live virus. It's going to hit food. It's going to hit water. The incubation day is 5 days. After that, people start to get dehydrated, and the WHO says usually cholera outbreaks encompass 75% of the populace. So that's going to overwhelm their so-called social medicine over there, just like we have here. So it doesn't look good, and I think we should pray for, of course, any country that's going to be sprayed with that. We've been sprayed in California with the West Nile virus. And basically what happens there is it's called a DNA vaccine enhancement recombinant vaccine. And scientists working on that project know that the disease lays dormant. And when people are exposed to it and then fall under stress, especially if you've had the chickenpox, you will get shingles. They've been spraying since 2006, but in 2009, people started getting sick. They started having nausea, lightheadedness, muscle aches, and back pain. So when doctors did a blood analysis on these sick people who had been exposed to the West Nile virus sprays, they found that it was a GMO version. It was also mixed with Epstein-Barr virus and also bioengineered with other viruses. And the doctors wrote and concluded that these people became ill and suffered from what is, quote, a DNA vaccination via viral nasal inhalation. So what happens is, they make these dry powdered vaccines, and they make it so that it targets the bronchopulmonary mucosa. Within just a few breaths, you are vaccinated within a minute. And it also targets your white macrophages of your immune system and your antigen adaptive cells called dendrites in your respiratory tract. So they know what they're doing. They really do. And they're also get ready for the VMAT2 gene to be in your influenza vaccines. This is coming from the Department of Justice and the Pentagon. They have identified this gene to be the central area of the brain that is involved with or associated with religious fundamentalism. So they want to vaccinate people with this gene to get rid of, quote, religious associations that cause problems. All right, there you go.
Well, you know, Bill Gates stated that we can, you know, his statement was that they can combat global warming with population reducement via vaccinations.
Yeah, well, that ought to tell a lot of people something. Their red flags should be going up all over the place. I don't know why people tolerate this stuff. And even Dr. Anthony Morris said in 76, it's all a hoax. And he worked for the FDA's vaccine program, and he got fired for it. But anyway, there's no scientific evidence that supports any benefits, and he came out and said that on the Phil Donahue show in 1976.
Unbelievable. Wendy, give us some information. We're out of time.
I know. Thepowerherbs.com is the website if you'd like to check us out. Of course, you can call toll-free for a free product catalog. Of course, heavenly protection from your herbs, folks. 866-229-3663. 866-229-3663. Thanks, Melody.
Thank you, and we'll see you next week. We'll talk to you next week. And, folks, Alfred Adusk and James Corbett will be here right after these short breaks. Thank you.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad spectrum immune boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll free 866-229-3663 or online thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663 or thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Folks, I'm Alfred Adusk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Our guest this evening is James Corbett. He's supposed to be our guest. Producer has not yet told me if Mr. Corbett is or is not yet here. I'd really like to know. James, are you here?
I'm here.
All right, good. That takes it. Our producer, he's got this thing about taking the wings off of flies. You understand? He likes to torment little creatures and radio hosts where we don't know. I don't know. Am I going to have a guest? Not going to have a guest. I'm sure he gets he's much amused by this. I'm not necessarily all that. I don't find it all that funny. But James Corbett is the mind behind the Corbett Report, Corbett Report, .com. He's been publishing that website and articles on there since 2007 as an analysis, as an independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. Also editorial writer of the International Forecaster, weekly e-newsletter created by the recently deceased Bob Chapman. And although he's usually here for our for an interview each week, you're not going to be here for 2 weeks coming up. And it's my understanding that's because at least one of these, Jeff Berwick, is having a something called the Dollar of the Dollar Vigilante. And he's having Anarchapulco, the first international anarchist anarcho-capitalist conference of its type, which will be held in Acapulco, Mexico, February 24th, March 1st, 2015, with speakers including Luke Radowski, Dan Dix, Roger Ver, Cody Wilson, and James Corbett. So you're going to the Anarchapulco meeting in Acapulco. And my question is to you first, are you an anarchist, anarcho-capitalist? How do you fit in and how do you define anarchist?
Good question. Well, first of all, I should clarify, I won't be here next week because of a family commitment, and this Anarchapulco will be at the end of February, so I'll be missing that edition of this radio broadcast as well. But yes, the question is a good one because these terms are so loaded with people's preconceptions and misconceptions that yeah. I think they can be very off-putting for people. So the way that I would define myself politically, I don't tend to use the word anarchist as a self-definition because of those preconceptions that I talk about. And obviously there's now over a century of basically the idea of bomb-wielding bearded terrorists being associated with that word. That is far from what I would place myself in. And of course, the anarchist tradition is really a tradition of the left, the radical far left. In fact, almost really a socialist tradition, which I don't really associate myself with either. So I understand. I mean, a lot of people who call themselves anarchists absolutely despise anarcho-capitalism and think that's not anarchism. And I don't want to get into those types of disputes because I think that places all of the emphasis in the wrong place. Basically, all anarchism means is without rulers, i.e. people who do not believe that there should be, that there are a special class of people who have, by virtue of whatever magic process takes place in society, whether that be the royal divine right of kings or whether that be some sort of magic vote or however it is bestowed on someone, that they have some rights that the average person does not have. So that's the sort of idea behind anarchism in general, but that doesn't say a lot about the specific type or emphasis of the anarchism in question. I think there are a lot of different types of anarchism, individualist anarchism and socialist anarchism and anarcho-capitalism and all sorts of other types. Basically, the way I would define myself politically is I would say I'm a voluntarist, and that places the emphasis on the fundamental ethical principle that I think underlies all of this, which is that I believe that no one has a right to come in and interfere and interact with a consenting agreement between two adults who freely contract with each other in the free and open marketplace. And basically what that means is that no one can initiate violence against someone who is acting peacefully, whether that be a man wearing a shiny badge and a fancy hat or any other type of person claiming to have some sort of magic authority that allows them to come in and initiate violence against peaceful people. And so the fundamental underlying concept here is not really a political one so much as it is a moral one. And it's really as simple as the morals that we learn in kindergarten. Don't steal what other people's possessions, and don't hit other people, you know, out of rage or whatever. And that's pretty much it. And from that principle,
but as a practical matter, I'm pretty sure I can remember some of the kids stealing my milk or graham crackers back when I was in kindergarten. And even though we were taught not to do that, you're talking about some pretty well-established tendencies within our species. I mean, for every anarchist out there saying, oh, you can't legally push us around, there's at least one Nazi who says, oh, yes, we can. How do you resolve?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah, I don't dispute that at all. Yeah. I certainly don't think of this as a utopian philosophy. I think of it as a very pragmatic one, because the I understand completely what you're saying. There will always be people in society who do aggress and do initiate violence. And so the outcome of that for most people is, well, then we need a state to stop those people from doing that. And to me, that is kind of mind-boggling, because it assumes a number of things. I mean, first of all, it assumes that somehow from the pool of people that we know and we admit and we all agree are inherently, in some way or other, all of us are inclined at some point or other to be an aggressor and to break those types of moral and ethical principles that at least most of us try to live up to. But no one of us is perfect. No one out there has lived a perfect life. So from that pool of people, we're somehow going to select people who are going to enforce these actions and give them special powers to enforce these actions, as if they're going to use those powers in a good way, which I think is a bit of a contradiction. Also,
absolutely.
I mean, the idea that we're going to stop people from initiating violence by giving people the power to initiate violence, again, seems like a contradiction to me. So I think that this is just the most pragmatic way of dealing with the question of what do you do with the corruption that inevitably comes with power. And I think that's the real, the Pollyanna-ish aspect of all of this, is the people who believe that somehow there is some way of instituting that fundamental violence and force in society that is the stick of government without having it be corrupted. And I think the closest or the most noble expression of that idea of human freedom that has been attempted, politically speaking, occurred in the United States in the late 18th century, or what
I
became the United States. That was, I mean, there were some of the smartest people in the world and some of the greatest political philosophers of human history seriously dedicating themselves to the question of how do you create a society based on fundamental human freedom and virtue and liberty. And of course, from the very outset, from the very beginning, it was flawed. It was a good attempt, and there was some nice rhetoric, but it was flawed. It whatever you want to say about it, it inevitably became what it has become now, which is not, absolutely not, a place of that same expression of human freedom and virtue.
Do you think that expression can be regained? Do you think
not politically? No.
You don't think it can
really
be regained politically?
No, that's where the fundamental point for me in all of this is that the solution to all of this is not going to be a political solution. And I think it's our tendency to look for political solution, which is the most insidious problem with all of this. Because,
yeah, I know.
Again,
we're looking
whether
for
you're
daddy, kiss my boo-boos and fix this problem. Go fight with Timmy's dad, beat him up because Timmy gave me a hard time. We're
right.
Looking
it's
for
even,
somebody to do our fighting
worse. Yeah, it's even worse than that, because it's not just because there's the daddy government idea that we're going to have the big strong government to tell people what to do and to force their, you know, the rules on people, or there's going to be mummy government to come and kiss the boo-boos and make everything better. And so you can be caught up in that system of arguing, well, do I want a daddy government or do I want a mommy government? And that can does usually consume people their entire lives, and they get to choose a side and advocate for that side and get lost in the left, right, blue, red kind of thing, and not realize fundamentally that there are other ways of conceptualizing how we can organize ourselves as society rather than looking for a daddy or a mommy government.
So your argument is, or your at least ideal, is the answer, do you want a mommy government, do you want a daddy government? The answer is none of the above. We'd
like
some other arrangement, because either way, it turns into something unfortunate. It gets too big. Is government just bad because of its size? Is the idea of government inherently bad, or is it bad because government they want to grow all the time, and they get bigger and bigger, and they become, as a function of magnitude, not necessarily government, but is magnitude, or is it the government itself that's the problem?
I sympathize with the minarchist position, and I guess pragmatically speaking, I think minarchism is a way of starting to dismantle at least the barriers in people's minds to this idea that we need government for any possible problem in society. I mean, we have to confront that before we even start thinking about the idea of removing government. So I think, yes, I'm certainly sympathetic to the minarchist idea, but fundamentally...
And when you say minarchist, You're not saying anarchist, you're saying minarchist, and I assume you mean minimum government.
Yes, I'm sorry, make that clear. Yes, minarchism is basically the idea that we just need a government for just protection of our basic rights, so sort of the Bill of Rights kind of concept, and just the absolute minimum government that's needed to protect everyone's property rights and make sure, you know, that bad people go to jail or something of that nature, just the sort of minimum government that's needed. However, I think that was kind of the embodying ethos of a lot of the people in the beginning of the U.S., not all of them, of course, but a lot of the spirit behind it was that, and it became the most one of the most tyrannical monstrosities that has ever plagued the world with the Pax Americana and NATO and all of this police state tyranny that's going on under Obama and his cohorts on the left and right over the past several decades. So I think that I think we have to look deeper than just the question of trying to minimize government, because that has never worked in history at any rate, whether or not it's even theoretically possible.
Well, I'm not an anarchist or a minarchist. I'm a pogoist, which means I subscribe to the philosophy, we have met the enemy and they are us.
Mm.
Here's an article that was, the Washington Times. Exclusive, secret tapes undermine Hillary Clinton on Libyan war. And the first paragraph is, top Pentagon officials and a senior Democrat in Congress so distrusted Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton's 2011 march to war in Libya that they opened their own diplomatic channels with the Gaddafi regime in an effort to halt the escalating crisis. This is according to a secret audio recording recovered from Tripoli just in the last little while. I don't know if you're familiar with this or this strikes you as important, but we have, if this is a true story, and again, this is in the Washington Times, this should be, this is a credible story. If the military and one government and one Democrat in Congress have worked to open up their own diplomatic channels to the Gaddafi regime to try to stop the assault on Libya back a couple of years ago, what do we actually have for government right now? If they don't distrust Hillary, the Secretary of State, and they can set up their own channels, do we have anything like a monolithic government, or is this just a free-for-all where anyone who's in something like a position of power can do whatever moves him on any given day?
Well, thank you for bringing this story to my attention. I hadn't seen it yet. So this is an interesting little piece of that puzzle. And I think this type of story is very helpful for the general public that does tend to think of government as a monolithic entity, whereas in reality, and in specifically in the American context, I mean, it's a million people that range all over the map in all sorts of different departments and different bureaucratic nests that have different agendas and different ideas and are sometimes working in concert and sometimes working against each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to have that understanding that these types of things go on even behind the Secretary of State's back. Secret diplomatic channels are opened. We saw recently a report come out about the secret diplomatic channels that are being that have been opened or were attempted to be opened. It's not clear which, between the U.S. and Russia, by which they were trying to get Henry Kissinger to call up his old friend Putin to try to establish some secret diplomatic channels. These types of things go on all the time in various ways in different administrations. And I think it is, as you say, it's important for us to understand this and not as a monolithic entity, but as this kind of multivariate system of competing interests or sometimes colliding or even in concert interests that are working in different ways. And this has huge implications for every level of...
Because this isn't just a question of I'm going to say President Obama is going to set up some secret diplomatic channels to deal with Gaddafi, for example. We've got Secretary of State Clinton. She's doing one thing that's out in the open that the public can see. Other parts of the government are doing something in secret. That's not a surprise. But when we see other parts of the government operating contrary, we're not just talking about having secret channels that are both, they're playing both ends against the middle. We're talking about a secret channel that is working contrary to the Secretary of State. You see what I'm saying? Well, there's antagonism here. There's not merely, you know, a multiplicity. There's antagonism. And what does that all mean?
Well, I think this is an interesting window into potentially even much more important stories, like the one that kind of flitted across the news radar and was flirted with, but not really brought to the attention of the public, talking about a loose nuke scenario that was talked about and reported on by the alternative media a year and a half ago. And there was bits and pieces that were coming out in the establishment media. But basically, I can't remember the details of which base.
I think they were located somewhere down in Texas. The nukes were supposedly in Texas, and they were allegedly shipped to the East Coast.
Right.
For reasons that were unclear and never verified. But we can talk more about that in a moment. We're going to break for some commercial announcements. I'm Alfred Addis, here with James Corbett on Financial Survival. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Financial obligations or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here in Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. My guest is James Corbett, who's calling in from Japan. And we will get on with, let's try this. Here's an article from Prophecy News Watch. And the headline is Obama Army Deploys to Tel Aviv to Topple Netanyahu. Now, they're talking about the military, but they say a consulting firm, almost entirely composed of former staffers of President Obama's re-election campaign, has been hired to run an election effort in Israel aimed at defeating Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, this strikes me as interesting politics. I mean, why doesn't Netanyahu and Obama just settle this in the ring, get it out of their system?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it does seem like that, doesn't it? And yes, I mean, I think this is something that we've all seen playing out in the headlines in various ways over the last few years, the big rift between Obama and Netanyahu. I don't know. I mean, at the end of the day, does it actually affect U.S. relations with Israel? And I'm not sure that it really does. I mean, we saw certainly the absolute support for the operations in Gaza last August. So I don't think it's actually changed anything in that regard politically. But it wouldn't surprise me if there's political machinations to get out a certain member of the Likudniks or whatever out of power, and someone who would be more cooperative with the Obama. And I forget what the latest was. Some sort of, I guess, Netanyahu wants to speak in front of Congress, but he forgot to even mention that to the Obama administration. So
now the Congress invited him without even considering what, what the president found out about it, I guess, literally through the news media. Who knows? Yeah. Maybe he's listening to alternative media, so he may be able to learn what's really going on in this country. I'm not sure. I was just curious if you had any comment. What do you think is going to happen? Is the Israeli-U.S. political relationship, is it badly damaged? Is it fragile right now? Or is this just a spat that you see between husbands and wives from time to time?
Yeah, I really don't see this as anything more than maybe not window dressing per se. There may be real differences here and real clash between Obama and Netanyahu. But again, I don't think it actually changes fundamental underlying foreign policy here. I don't see anything driving any wedge between the U.S. and Israel fundamentally in terms of their foreign policy goals in the Middle East. It never has been, and I don't imagine it ever will, until the fall of, Israel or the United States or something fundamental.
If the United States goes down, I would say Israel won't be too far behind. Mm. If Israel goes down, I don't know, we'll still be here, I assume. But even so, both nations are, the entire West is in a certain amount of trouble here.
Well, in that regard, specifically talking about those foreign policy considerations, I think that the death of King Abdullah is going to be interesting. I'm not expecting a title change per se in the direction that things are heading. But given that we're already on this type of realignment that's going on that sees Saudis, a sort of U.S.-Saudi, if not a rift per se, at least a somewhat distancing, and we'll have to see how that starts to play out. But of course, that, of course, directly pertains to the U.S.-Israel relationship as well, and sort of the entire shaping of the Middle East. So some at least potential for some pretty tectonic moves are taking place right now.
Yeah, we've got a new prime minister. I'm not sure what they call the leader for Saudi Arabia, but the former head, he passed on. I'm going to guess that the replacement will come in and kind of sit on his hands for 60 days or so before he starts to implement his own policy. But I'm wondering whether or not he's going to change policy in terms of how much oil is being produced.
I believe the early indications are, from what's being reported, that there will be no change, and that's what they're saying. But I've also seen some sort of indication that there's going to be high-level meetings between Saudi Arabia and Russia and some other partners talking about oil prices. So I don't know. I don't know what this means. This is something that, in fact, I'm researching right now for this weekend's forecaster. I'm going to be writing an editorial specifically about all of this. But as I say, it will be interesting to see because, again, this at least presents an inflection point that could be a turning point in U.S.-Saudi relations, or could be seen as that from some future vantage point. And I'm not sure that will be apparent right away, but it will at least give the Saudis a sort of proximate excuse for ramping up this growing distancing that they've been doing with the U.S. in the last few years.
Well, my understanding of the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States is that the United States essentially guaranteed Saudi security starting about 1971, 72 in that area in return for the Saudis guaranteeing to sell their crude oil only for U.S. dollars. Now, the question is, does the United States still have enough muscle to protect Saudi Arabia? Does Saudi Arabia still trust the United States to provide that security, or are they beginning to realize, wait a second, we've got to start taking care of ourselves? And do you agree with that analysis? Is that what's happening, or is it something other than that?
Well, that's obviously the backbone of it. You're talking about the petrodollar alliance that was created in the 70s and that has been the backbone of the dollar since the decoupling from gold in the closing of the gold window under Nixon. So, yes, this is the backbone of the world economy that we're talking about, really. And Again, there's so
that's
many.
That's true. You know, I hadn't thought of that, but that's a fact. This really is the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia. Because it created the petrodollar, it becomes the cornerstone of the modern world government setup.
Mm-hmm.
And if something happens to that relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia, a lot of things are going to start to shake, rattle, and roll.
Well, that's it. I mean, we had bread and woods from the end of the Second World War until the petrodollar era, and now we're in the petrodollar era, and we keep hearing talk about a bread and woods 2 and kind of a new arrangement for global currency. But until that point, at any rate, we have this petrodollar, which is kind of still in place, but it's more and more tenuous. I mean, there's more and more cracks that are forming. And again, I mean, the question is not just one of regional security, although obviously that's part of it. But as we've seen, I mean, startlingly so in the last few months, this has incredible shockwaves that will be felt across the world geopolitically and economically. And again, it's just such an interesting inflection point given what's happening with the oil price right now and the manipulation to keep it down, coupled with, I think, a very real deflationary undertow in the global economy. And that's all combining to seem to be coming to some sort of head. And again, I don't want to call timeframes and things of that nature, but I mean, I can't envision how the confluence of the death of King Abdullah, this oil manipulation, the deflation that we see going on, the newly announced euro trillion, 1.1 trillion euros they're going to be printing out of nothing. All of this coming together at this time just seems like we are heading towards some very, very large changes on the geopolitical chessboard in the near future. And that's not going to be pleasant, I'm sure, but it will be interesting to watch.
I've got an article from CNBC. The headline is "Everyone is Scared." Nobel Prize winner Schiller. They're talking about Robert Schiller. He won the Nobel Prize for economics in 2013. He says the human race has deep underlying fears about technology and the lives their children will lead, and this can be seen in all places, in the negative yields of bond markets. And this is according to Schiller. He says, "I think fears have been growing for years that represent the willingness of people to bid up bond prices." And he goes back, he has another paragraph down below here. He says, "There's this increasing fear of technology, information technology, artificial intelligence, robotics, 3D printers, the internet, and all these different forms," he said. "The technology, he added, seems to be changing life in such a fundamental way. And what it's leaving people thinking is, where will I be in 30 years? Look how fast everything is changing now. Where will my children be? I want to leave something for them because they could be in terrible straits." And it's interesting to me that Mr. Schiller is not saying, "Well, there's some crazy people on the right wing or whatever who are getting a little paranoid." He's saying, no, the world is in this state of fear from his perspective. Do you think he's exaggerating the problem, or is he fundamentally accurate?
I don't think it's an exaggeration. I think there is the fear, and it's not a baseless fear. It has very, very real roots in the real world that's going on right now. I mean, people might have seen this week that apparently Apple is, you know, the savior of the American economy or something, because they've just posted the biggest quarterly profit of all time. And this is supposed to be some sign of the, I guess, resurgent American economy. I don't know, as if we're going to feed ourselves with iPhone apps or something like that. But I mean, look at the flip side of that. At the exact same time that Apple is announcing the biggest profit in history because iPhone 6 was such a runaway success, the Apple supplier Foxconn, which has been under a microscope for the last few years as a place where they put up the suicide netting to stop the workers from throwing themselves off a roof because they're basically slave labor and stuff like that, they have just announced that they're going to be drastically cutting back their workforce because of a declining revenue growth and rising wages in China. And what are they going to be replacing it with? They're going to be using more robots, arms to complete mundane tasks. So I mean, this isn't something that people should be fearing in an abstract sense. I mean, it is something that affects people's lives.
This is real, and it's here now.
Exactly. I've seen it in my life. I'm relatively young. I'm 35, and I've seen the huge fundamental underlying changes in the economy in my lifetime, let alone people who are, you know, decades more seasoned than I. So I'm not implicating you in anything there.
No, but don't worry about it. But I've got 2 years for every one of yours, and I guarantee you it's one of those things you sit back, and if you do think about it, it's like, holy cow. I look at movies sometimes that were made back about the time I was born. They have more in common with the Wild West, the 1800s, than they do with today. The kind of technology changes and one thing, and it's, you look at it and you say, oh my gosh, what's going to happen here? And what is going to happen? There are companies that want to move back from, they left this, you know, the industries that left the United States, moved to China, for example. A number of them want to come back now, but when they come back, they're not going to bring the jobs that they took with them. They're going to come back with robots, and they're not going to revive. What are we going to do with the labor force in this country in a world where robots become increasingly common?
Well, firstly, just on that note of perspective, which really, I mean, one that really hit home for me was the idea that we are now as far from the time in which Back to the Future was released as Back to the Future was from the 1950s that it was portraying, which was one of those moments that made me think, well, back to my childhood. Oh, wow. But yes, I mean, that is so important to keep in mind just how far removed we are from that world that we grew up in. And as someone who literally works as a podcaster, which was a concept I was completely unfamiliar with literally a decade ago, let alone even imagined that I would be doing for a full-time living. I mean, it is a strange world that we're entering, and there really is an acceleration to this. I mean, of course, people have gone through massive changes in the past, but there is an acceleration to the rate of change itself, which has been talked about before. And of course, Ray Kurzweil and others point to this as the singularity. We're heading to this point at which the technology will be changing faster than we can even keep up with it as human beings. And
but you know, some of us have a chance to keep up with it. At least for a while. You're an intelligent man. A lot of the threats that we perceive right now are not going to affect highly intelligent individuals, at least not immediately and en masse. But what are you going to do for people who really don't have the intelligence or education to do much more than dig ditches and sweep floors? They're going to be replaced. I mean, there's not going to be work for them. What will we do?
Well, this is where I think the depopulation agenda of so many of the people who have been in positions of power for so long comes into play, because I think they've foreseen this. I mean, we had Brzezinski writing about the technotronic era back in the 1970s, basically talking about the internet before the internet really existed in the form that it does, and predicting all of this that was going to happen. And a fundamental part of that technotronic era he was writing about was control of populations, control of information, control of the habits of those populations and the way they are trained to think and do things. And, of course, the author of that, Brzezinski, just a couple of years ago said we are now living in a world, whereas 30 years ago it was easier to control a million people than to kill a million people. We might be living in the opposite world at this point, i.e. it's easier to kill people than to control them. So, unfortunately, that's where we start getting into the very, very bleak stuff of what this really could be going in terms of the geopolitical machinations that I was talking about earlier.
Well, we're entering a time that's not just going to be challenging on an economic basis. It's going to be challenging on a moral basis, unlike anything we've perhaps ever seen before. There are rational people that believe that the population needs of not just this country, but the world needs to be dramatically diminished. And their arguments, morally wrong, but rationally, they're fairly solid. What are we going to do with these people? We are all going to be faced with these questions and how we answer them. I'm not looking forward to being even faced with the questions. And I don't think any of the rest of us are either. In any case, James, I want to thank you for being on the program. We're out of time. I'll be back with James, not next week, but the following week, and be back tomorrow. In the meantime, with the good Lord, bless you, meet James Frank, the producer, James Corbett from The Corbett Report, CorbettReport.com, CORBETT. Take a look.
Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.
Money must be funny.